Hello, everybody, and welcome to today's webinar, the topic of decoding Parkinson's subtypes. I would love to welcome Dr. Alberto Espe. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Polly. I'm so happy to be here and just delighted to see how vibrant this community is.
So tell us, Alberto, tell us about you.
Well, thank you, Polly. I'm a neurologist that was very interested in Parkinson's from my early training as a neurologist at Indiana University. I did my Parkinson's and Movement Disorder Fellowship at the University of Toronto. I did also there a separate but complementary master's in clinical epidemiology, as well as a fellowship in electrophysiology of movement disorders. And in 2005, I came to the University of Cincinnati, where I have been since. So that's a total of 19 years. I have been very much involved in every kind of research on Parkinson's, initially with the idea of understanding people with Parkinson's difficulties, motor or non-motor aspects, but then also in treatments and ultimately trying to even rethink the idea of what is Parkinson's, what is it that what we call Parkinson's? So kind of going back to the basics to some extent in a large arc of intellectual endeavor. I almost feel as if we know a lot less now in terms of what we think we knew than what I thought I knew back in 2005. But it's been also an important journey because I think that the best way to get us somewhere is to acknowledge what we don't know, as opposed to pretending to know. We've been pretending to know a lot, and that's problematic at many levels. And of course, my patients humbled me time and again because I used to think I knew what was ahead for people. And people would ask me, well, now I have Parkinson's disease, please, Dr. Espe, tell me what's ahead of me. And of course, there was a time I was fool enough to believe I knew what was ahead of them. And I was always wrong in every direction until I realized I was so wrong with one particular woman with Parkinson's who I somehow was silly enough to believe I knew what was ahead of her, and it wasn't very promising. So I was even talking about years, and I must have made a statement that came across as I'm only giving this person 3 years to live. And she looked at me and said, I don't have time for this. I have too much going on. There's lots of things that I'm looking forward to that I know I'm going to be doing. And I just don't have time for this crappy prognosis you're giving me. And she has proven me wrong for these 19 years that I've been in Cincinnati. She was one of my early patients. So whenever I remember her, I'm mindful that there is so much power within each person with Parkinson's disease that's untapped, that we know is there, that somebody like me doesn't have access to, but it is there because my patients have taught me that. So
I love that. I got goosebumps when you said that. Mm-hmm. And I wish for our community that everybody had a movement disorder neurologist specialist like you who learned early on about that and has adapted their practice based on that. We hear from our community so many stories that don't align with that, like your early days. So thank you. Having been an organization working in this space for 20 years, and Alberto, you've been a big part of those 20 years. Let's, as Marge has just asked, what are subtypes? Can you tell us, when we jumped into this work, we realized pretty quickly that no two people living with Parkinson's were experiencing the same kinds of symptoms. And it leads to some people flippantly use the phrase, If you've seen one person with Parkinson's, you've seen one person with Parkinson's. And that maybe isn't as robust an explanation as is really needed. So can you help us sort of define what do we mean by this? And what have you seen in your practice and your research?
Right. It's an important question, Polly, because what we are really facing here is this concept that if we mean it when we say not two patients are alike, then there can't be a Parkinson's disease, right? We cannot say to a patient, you're blazing your own trail, which we know is true. Everybody's different. That's why we don't use staging in our practice. We never tell a patient what stage we think that individual is, because that implies that there is a script for that person that's already pre-established, and that is also false. So if we know, and it's no longer under debate, that not two people are alike, we cannot then follow that statement by saying, but be hopeful, there will be a biomarker of Parkinson's and a treatment that will slow Parkinson's. Because the savvy patient would say to somebody like me, wait a minute, didn't you just say that I was unique, that I'm having my own brand of Parkinson's, and now you're telling me that that uniqueness come to a halt because of course there will be something that will work for everyone as unique as I am. The key challenge of our era, which subtyping aims to resolve, is to break away from the cognitive dissonance that there can't be different kinds of Parkinson's and hope for a cure of Parkinson's. Those two things can't be true. And of course, saying we're going to cure Parkinson's is warm and fuzzy, but no one has ever been able to prove curing a disease in any field of medicine. We haven't cured cancer, but look at the progress of curing people with cancer, right? And that came after a particular pivotal moment in the field of oncology, when this one trial, they needed only one trial of a comparison between a radical mastectomy and a breast-preserving surgery, demonstrated there was no difference between those two groups, right? Up till then, it was the breast cancer was one bad disease of the breast. This study showed that, well, if there is no difference, maybe breast cancer is not one disease of the breast. Maybe it's many. And look at the progress that has been made in the subsequent nearly 4 decades now. We have for too long insisted that we know what Parkinson's is, so let's not question it. And it's only now beginning to realize, well, maybe we need to go into subtyping. So what is subtyping? Subtyping is the acknowledgement that there are types within Parkinson's, subtypes, individuals that are going to follow a particular behavior because they have a particular biology. And that Jim's Parkinson's belongs to a subtype that isn't as Mary's Parkinson's, as George's Parkinson's, as Jim's Parkinson's, that everyone has a different type. And so it is a form of splitting. We have both lumping and splitting, and there has always been a tension between those two philosophies of approaching Parkinson's. Lumping has historically won. We just simply say Parkinson's disease is a heterogeneous condition. We say, oh, it's very varies a lot. There's lots of people with Parkinson's, bad Parkinson's, but it's a one beast, a one multi-headed beast. It's a collection of distinct animals. And that's the splitting. And splitting requires for us to go into subtyping. Lumping is still okay when we go after eloquent common denominators. One form of lumping is to say Parkinson's disease is a syndrome that results from dopamine deficiency, the reduction in the production of dopamine by the brain. So then if you have therapies that elevate the concentration of dopamine in the brain, it's a form of lumping. You're giving that to everyone with the diagnosis, you get good results. And we have levodopa as the most important therapy we still have. Levodopa to Parkinson's, what insulin is to diabetes. But we don't have, through levodopa, what's referred to as a disease-modifying intervention, because it just targets a common denominator. You have to go upstream, but the more upstream we go in terms of biology, why is it that Jim is not making enough dopamine compared to Mary, then we have to split. Then we have to figure out what is it about Jim's Parkinson's that made it so and differs from Mary's. So that's sort of, that's the whole idea of stop subtyping. And is the most important concept to reconcile this idea that not two people with Parkinson's are alike.
That's really helpful. That's been really helpful for me to understand the sort of baseline of what does this really mean? Before we jump into what are the different subtypes and how do we categorize, or what are examples of subtypes that we're looking at? A question came in about maybe a bigger umbrella level, which is, what is Parkinsonism and how does it different from Parkinson's? I know this is a little different from subtypes, but it might help ground people in what we're talking about.
Well, Parkinsonism is lumping on steroids. You said lumping, splitting being right tipping in subtypes. So Parkinsonism is the collection of all Parkinson's subtypes together, plus Parkinson's-like conditions. So Parkinsonism is a term that we use when we don't really know if all the features will check all the boxes of the criteria for a diagnosis of Parkinson's disease. We say, gosh, there is slowness of movements, there is stiffness, but there are these other things that are not fitting into any of those boxes. Rather than committing to a diagnosis of Parkinson's, we say, let's just call it Parkinsonism. It could be Parkinson's disease, but it can potentially also be a Parkinson's-like condition other than Parkinson's disease. And so Parkinsonism is sort of a less specific term, is more vague, and deliberately so. I'm all for using vague terms if we don't know. I prefer uncertainty and the declaration of uncertainty than false certainty. Well, this is Parkinson's, and then realizing in retrospect, no, that never was, but we were too quick to jump into the idea that that was Parkinson's. And unfortunately, we see a number of people in our practice that have come with the diagnosis of Parkinson's and it isn't, or a diagnosis of another Parkinsonism, when in fact it may have been Parkinson's disease, although that's less common.
Interesting. All right. Let's jump into the get a little bit more specific and jump into the different subtypes of Parkinson's and how your big grouping starts to get a little narrower. Can you tell us about the examples?
Yeah, so the most common current example of splitting into subtypes is genetic subtypes. There are both causes of Parkinson's that are genetic in nature, and there are genetic risks for Parkinson's that they alone cannot induce Parkinson's unless there is something else happening, the nature of which often we don't know, but it is strong enough of a risk factor that we're able to tell that somebody with a mutation in that particular gene could then give rise to features of what we call Parkinson's. So those are ways to narrow down the field of Parkinson's disease into more genetically driven forms of Parkinson's. So genetic subtypes. Mm-hmm. Genetic subtypes are currently thought of as much more likely to be the subject of interventions that would work in a more specific fashion for the kind of biology that the gene is known to affect. So if you are able to introduce a therapy that helps correct some of the biological changes that come from a genetic mutation associated with Parkinson's, then that has a higher chance of getting us past the finish line in a trial aiming at disease modification, at slowing the progression of Parkinson's. We have zero successes in disease modification. We have very many, very good, in many cases good, symptomatic therapies. therapies that help the symptoms, many of which, of course, are working by virtue of helping the common denominator of dopamine deficiency, but other neurotransmitters are also subject of this kind of approach. They don't affect the disease. They don't have disease-modifying strategy, largely because we've been using those therapies to everyone in a lumping approach. So as I mentioned, the lumping approach works well for symptomatic therapies, never works for disease modification. It can't work because we already know that not two people are alike. So the genetic subtyping is the first movement in the direction of narrowing the field. Instead of saying, I'm going to have a therapy that will cure Parkinson's, which I hope that by now we've established it's not possible, then let's kind of narrow that to a slice that we think has a much narrower biological determination, and particularly something for which we have a therapy. So that's where we're heading. But there are many other forms of subtyping. The genetic subtyping is the one that makes the most sense because we already have tests that determine whether somebody does or doesn't have a gene that causes Parkinson's or that increases the risk of Parkinson's. And there is a subtle difference between those two categories. But once we're there, then we are saying, all right, we have someone who has LRRK2, for instance, that's a particular gene that causes Parkinson's, or GBA, that's a gene that increases the risk for Parkinson's. And there are now therapies designed to address the biology that gets disrupted when you have one of these mutations so that people can come into those trials. They're going to be specifically selected for therapies that, of course, would make sense to use for them. There are other complexities that is probably not worth getting into, but that is sort of the idea of why subtyping of a genetic nature makes a lot of sense. So,
okay, so the question that I have from that is, given that 70%+ of our audience hasn't had a genetic test or know their subtype, if they have a genetic subtype, is it worth considering? Why would somebody want to go get a genetic test at this point?
The why is the best question to ask, really. Why to do this? There is a lot less importance to the why. There will be less importance to the why until we have something that, of course, we can do for it. And we don't have now that. Now, but there are two key benefits to getting a genetic determination, if in fact there is a genetic subtype. One is that by knowing your genetic risk or genetic cause of your Parkinson's, now you're in, now there's a whole lot of literature. You can become an expert in that kind of Parkinson's disease. And then depending on the particular type of mutation within the gene, you can begin to tease out whether there are groups of individuals connected to a research program that are devoted to that particular kind of, so ends the search for what caused my Parkinson's, largely not completely, but it's a good destination to that question. And B, connects you with research done anywhere in the world of this kind of genetic subtypes of Parkinson's, so that you're now having a much more specific pathway that you can then look forward to being part of and potentially benefiting from.
And I understand that not everybody has a genetic subtype. So you might get the test and learn
that
you don't have a variant, a genetic.
Right. So that's where we come into place. We at the University of Cincinnati have a platform that's very much borrowed from the playbook of oncology. When somebody, going back to the analogy with breast cancer, is told that there is breast cancer, the oncologist hastens to add, we don't know what it means. Mm-hmm. In fact, they say, we don't know what disease actually is for you. The way to get there is to do a number of evaluations to understand what kind of things you are going to be positive or negative for as we test you. Some of them are genetic, some of them are molecular, some of them are proteomic, some of them are tissue, et cetera. So there are different levels of information. We need to do that to be able to answer the question, what disease this actually is for you. so that then we can treat you. So what we have in Cincinnati is precisely the same platform. We are telling people, you have Parkinson's disease, we don't know what that means to you. We need to get to know you at a biological level with a variety of different things we're doing. We're measuring levels of different proteins in blood. We're using urine, and we're actually measuring DNA for microbial species in the stool. So we're doing microbiome analysis on the idea that the gut-brain connections may be important for certain forms of therapy. So we're doing all of that on the idea that we will one day be able to answer the question, what this is and why it came to be, so that then we can address it head on for what the source of the problem is, as opposed to saying, well, here, levodopa. But we would then, in that process, we acknowledge the importance of therapy. So we would say, do you fit the criteria for Parkinson's disease? We don't know what it is. We're going to start the search trying to answer the most important question, not what this is, but why this is. Then we'll be able to actually treat your disease and potentially reverse it. Meanwhile, here's levodopa to make you feel better.
Right. And exercise.
An exercise. Yes. Thank you. I have to parenthetically make the comment that whenever I explain to patients that we do not have any disease modifying therapies, I say, but there is an exception, and that exception is exercise. So that statement is incorrect. I'm making that statement as a pharmacotherapy statement.
Yes, of course.
About the drugs. We don't have any drugs that do it, but there is an intervention called exercise that is the best thing we actually have, and that I think that no patient should go without, because it's what separates those that do well exercise versus those who don't, that may not quite include exercise in the manner that perhaps they could or should.
Thank you for that. So we've talked about some of the subtypes. I see a couple of questions in the chat about other types of subtypes of Parkinson's around sort of age of onset or clinical presentation, the symptoms or symptom severity. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Yes. By and large, the earlier the age at onset, the likelier it is that we're dealing with a genetic subtype. And most genetic subtypes of earlier onset are clustered into fairly better expressions of Parkinson's than those that are non-genetic. So one way to consider genetic, by no means all of them, but in a good proportion, is thinking of people who have an early onset of disease under the age of 40 particularly, but even between the age of 40 and 50. Those that have fewer so-called non-motor symptoms, so less prevalence of anosmia or lack of sense of smell, less issues with constipation or no issues with constipation, no depression, no REM sleep behavior disorder, which is this dream enactment behaviors that people can have at night when they sleep. So if those are not present earlier age at onset, we think that the odds for a genetic subtype are very high. The odds are a lot less if you have an onset after the age of 60, have no family history, and have all these other non-motor aspects that I've listed. Those are highlighting something that we still refer to as idiopathic Parkinson's. A word, idiopathic, that means we don't know where it's coming from, why that is, but we have a good name for it, Parkinson's disease.
Okay, thank you for that. What about, we've heard a lot in the last year about alpha-synuclein and biomarkers. How do they relate to Parkinson's subtypes?
Well, so now we're back into the lumping versus splitting conversation. So one thing that happens in Parkinson's as a collective common denominator is the loss of dopamine. We've just spoke about that. There's less dopamine, and that correcting dopamine makes people feel better. So we're going after something that is happening to most people. Another lumpy thing, another thing that happens to everybody, another common denominator, is that there is a particular protein called synuclein or alpha synuclein, because actually we have alpha, beta, and gamma synuclein in our bodies. Alpha synuclein is a very important protein, is all over the body, brain, and all the way down to the toes. And it is a very important protein for a variety of different processes, not least among which is a protein that allows us to react to the world. If you have any kind of infection, synuclein goes up, is what also can be referred to as an acute phase reactant. So it's a very important protein for anyone to react to the environment in which we live. If something is happening to an individual that is going to be in the future known as a cause of Parkinson's, one common denominator is that it will affect synuclein. Synuclein will react against it. And that synuclein protein, in the process of reacting to it, will essentially end up dying. The form of death is known as Lewy bodies. Lewy bodies are the tombstones of synuclein. And back in the day, when we had only one technology, which was the microscope, we had to wait till people died, look at their brains after they were dead. And if people had something that today we call Parkinson's and they have Lewy bodies in their brain, we say, oh, here is the problem. In the late 90s, it became clear that those Lewy bodies were just made of synuclein. And so we thought that if Lewy bodies were the problem, removing synuclein was the solution. And we essentially, in the process, simply failed 101 of forensics. When you come to a crime scene, such as a brain autopsy, where information is gleaned to try to make sense of this, the nature of a crime, what you see in a crime scene usually is the victims, not the perpetrators of the crime. You never come to bloody corpses and say, here are the perpetrators of the crime. You say, here are the victims. Let's try to think how the crime had committed, and then let's try to think who the perpetrator would have been. Well, we violated that very simple rule. We came up and said, look at these things, look at these corpses. Let's call them Lewy bodies. Let's define them as the hallmark of Parkinson's, and let's conclude that they cause Parkinson's. So we've known that there is zero relationship between how much of that the brain has and what symptoms people have, or how much neurons they are losing. Zero. Even though it's the definition of Parkinson's, it turns out that there is very little relationship. In fact, some studies have shown that the more of the Lewy bodies you have, the more preserved brain you have. So it's actually probably protective in many ways. Or at least a reaction to something else. And that reaction is, of course, part of the defense mechanism. So what happens in the most recent times, and this is now finally coming to your question, is that there is now a test that allows us to determine whether there is already in somebody alive Lewy bodies, aggregated synuclein. We don't have to wait for an autopsy. We can do that test in a living individual. And it's a qualitative test, meaning that it just gives us a yes, no answer to the question, is there aggregated synuclein? Is there synuclein in a clumped fashion similar to what the Lewy bodies are in the brain? And if the answer is yes, as of this past year, that defines something that the Michael J. Fox Foundation is calling, quote, biologically defined Parkinson's disease. And it is false, because most of us will have a variety of different proteins getting involved and defending ourselves against a variety of age-related exposures, among them synuclein. So if you have a positive synuclein test in the population, that may or may not go along with Parkinson's. Now, if somebody has Parkinson's symptoms that are related to synuclein, this is the best test you can have to confirm it. But the best thing that this test does is to say, yep, that's Parkinson's. That's the only thing it does. What has happened is that the Michael J. Fox Foundation, as wonderful of people as they are, and with the best of intentions, I know, have taken that one step further and say, well, if you have a positive test, that also allows us to stage you, to see what stage you are. You can have one of the three elements to create a staging system. And we're already saying, oh, hold on a second, we're not using a staging. How could we then use it with a test that we know is going to correlate to the type of abnormality in the brain that we already know doesn't correlate with changes clinically. It doesn't matter how much of the Lewy bodies we have, it doesn't have a relationship with the symptoms we have or how much the brain could be harmed. It doesn't, because it doesn't do anything to the brain. Remember, it's synuclein. After all, we have it all over the body. We have it all over the body, and synuclein has been preserved since prehistoric genomes. It's all over the animal kingdom. So I'm glad that this question is asked, because this is the most important question for everyone with Parkinson's. I heard there is a test, and that test is magnificent. Should I have it? And honestly, if you have symptoms of Parkinson's disease, that test is probably just going to confirm it is. It's not going to add anything further to that. It's also going to tell that your Parkinson's is related to synuclein. But most people, Parkinson's are related to synuclein, not caused by synuclein, related to it. Synuclein is compromised, and now synuclein is acting as a soldier for you, and in the process becoming clumped, and you can now identify it before you die. That's really it. So it cannot define anybody's biology, because we're already establishing that not two people are alike. So there can't be a test that tells us there is this is the biological definition of Parkinson's. It violates that principle too. It cannot tell us anything about severity of someone's Parkinson's. It cannot tell us anything about whether someone's Parkinson's is predominantly motor or non-motor. It cannot help us with prognosis. Once it's positive, it remains positive. It therefore cannot help us with response to therapies, because no therapy can eliminate synuclein, as undesirable as that would be, and turn that test negative. It just won't happen. So it is a good test for one thing and one thing only: confirming that there is
Confirming.
Parkinson's disease. It's not good for anything else. The concern that I have, and the harm that could be inflicted at the population level, is to convince people that if you have this test, even if you have no symptoms, you have biological Parkinson's. And
Which
that
is
is
not
wrong.
right.
It's not right. It's not right. And why would one even know if somebody could develop Parkinson's, which this test doesn't predict? There is nothing to suggest that this test is going to say, oh, if you have that test, this is where you're heading. In fact, the authors acknowledged that much in the paper. At the population level, most of us at the end of our normal lifespans will have plenty of amyloid plaques in our brain. Amyloid plaques biologically define Alzheimer's. How could it be that that one abnormality that defines Alzheimer's is present in most of us without ever developing dementia? That should be a problem with the definition. And that's the problem we're having with the definition of Parkinson's today. So we're defining it by something that it cannot cause it. It's not a problem. Now, what happens is that if you have too many Lewy bodies and you're not making enough of the synuclein from which it comes, then the lower levels of synuclein are a problem. And in fact, it's been demonstrated that in Parkinson's disease, as the synuclein falls or misfalls into the Lewy bodies in the process of fending ourselves off against something, those levels do become very low. And the only biomarker in Parkinson's that predicts progression is how low the levels of spinal fluid synuclein are. If you have very low synuclein, that's a problem. That's something we would want to actually correct. But in this environment in which synuclein is the evil force that drives Parkinson's, it's very hard to get funding to get that going, because you are still immersed in a universe that believes — the word belief is not in the language of science, but we use it all the time — believes that synuclein in an aggregated fashion is the cause of Parkinson's, and we must destroy it. We must prevent its aggregation. We must try to
Right.
remove it from the brain, and there can't be anything positive emerging from it, just like there hasn't been anything positive emerging from cleaning the brain from amyloid in the field of Alzheimer's.
That's a lot. That's
I
a lot
know.
to process and think about, especially with the news surrounding us about the excitement and the newness and the innovation and around this discovery. It's hard to know what to trust and what's best for us.
And I have to emphasize, the intentions are good. So no
Of
one is
course.
saying this is there with a double face. I know that the intentions are very good, but sometimes blind belief in ideas is not good. We have married this idea that synuclein is evil, and once you marry an idea, no evidence will falsify it. That's not science. Science is all about the concept that all ideas are false until proven otherwise. And philosophers of science, particularly Karl Popper, back in the age, said, "Gosh, you have to demonstrate so often that the probability of an idea being false is so low, p value less than 0.05, to then and only then you can say it may be true." But we neurologists, I think, hide behind the idea the brain is very complex. And then we say, you know what, we have this idea, and then we conclude it's brilliant. And then we do the experiments to prove
how brilliant
it is, to confirm it. We already know what the idea is brilliant because we came up with it. So now we have experiments. They don't necessarily quite get traction. We change the experiment until eventually they tell us exactly what we want to hear. We torture data until it really says what we want the data to tell us. And that is not good for anyone. I have learned that our patients don't care who is right or who is wrong. They want to know that we're searching for the truth.
Yeah.
And we're not. We seem blindly moving down. And this new test to Parkinson's is being referred to as a paradigm shift. It's a paradigm entrenchment. We're back in the same old age of the 1900 where we felt that we saw this in the brain, but must be the problem. It looks abnormal, must be the cause of the problem. And now we have a test that is essentially as if we had the brain already, telling us that the brain would have that. And we're concluding the exact same statement that we came up in the 1910s.
Oh, wow.
1910s was when we decided that thing that in 1817, James Parkinson's referred to as a collection of symptoms that kind of hold together. There might be something. Then eventually it was determined a few decades later that all of these people had these Lewy bodies. And so James Parkinson must have been into something molecular, biological. No, he wasn't. He wasn't into it. So I think the key message for everyone listening is to take all of this hype with a grain of salt. We all want hope, and we all certainly, I have plenty of hope, but I don't want hope that is empty. I don't want to tell, you know, that dissonance. I don't want to tell people you are unique. But be hopeful because we'll have a cure for Parkinson's. No, I don't want to say that because it's false. It is a false idea. Those two things can be true. And it's past the time that we admit that it can be true. Therefore, let's not say it. And so this idea that there can ever be a biological definition of Parkinson's by a positive test of synuclein is entirely false. And it can be very harmful if people buy into the idea that by having a positive test that renders them candidates for anti-synuclein therapies. Many of which are in the pipeline. The pipeline for Parkinson's is 67% filled with lots of therapies that clean the brain from synuclein, and they have zero chance of success and a high chance of harm. Imagine if our patients were to say, you know what, I'm not going to participate in trials anymore, because we all say to patients, God, please participate in research. That's how we're going to advance. Well, you can participate in research all you want with these trials. Nothing good can come of it. And we're not going to take no from an answer for trials. We already have two anti-synuclein trials published that show nothing for it. We think it's the problem with the trials, not with our ideas. Took us 50 trials of anti-amyloid therapies to find one that we think is better. It's not good. It's a statistical difference in favor of the treatment. Most of the trials in the past, fivefold times more trials favor placebo statistically over the drug, but we never took those as saying, oh gosh, that's not the answer. So imagine if patients stop participating in those trials, forcing us societally to reckon with our ideas and say, maybe we need to change tack, because if our people are not going to be part of these studies, we cannot run these studies. Sometimes it's said that we need more money into research of Parkinson's. Yeah, we do need more money, but you can put all the money in the world into bad ideas, and the money will not save us.
So, Sharon just asked the question that was on my mind. When do you decide to participate or not participate in a trial? Because there must be some that you say, these are good, you should participate.
Yeah, so it's a great question. So as I mentioned, lumping is bleeding. If it's a treatment to help symptoms, lumping is okay. Meaning that I have Parkinson's, this therapy is going to help me and any of my symptoms, please consider participating. If there's a treatment trial for something that slow Parkinson's progression, the category of disease modification, I want people to ask the question to the person asking them to participate, why me? Right? And the answer might be something along the lines of, well, because you have Parkinson's and you are early. That's the wrong answer. No, I say, why me? Why would I participate in this particular study by virtue of my kind of Parkinson's that somehow will make the therapy work for me, but might not work for other members of my tribe, right? And if that generates well, no, this is therapy is expected to work in everyone with Parkinson's, then that's the wrong answer and you should not participate. Now, if somebody says, well, because you have a specific abnormality in the mitochondria and this therapy that I have is enhancing the mitochondrial function, you have a match, then yes. But those trials aren't happening yet. So if you ask the question, why me? And the question is going to be, oh, you have Parkinson's, so you're perfect. Try not to participate. And it's funny for me, I've been a researcher, but I'm first and foremost a doctor. I don't want to simply sell trials or just do trials because they are available and because they are profitable. I don't want to do any, we don't do any trials here that are anti-protein of any kind. And those are the trials that are happening, they have the most backing financially. So I want people to simply ask the question and just say no. Say no if there is no chance that the trial that you're getting into knows anything about you biologically, if it is a molecular therapy or if it is an anti-protein. Anti-protein therapies just can't work because proteins are not the cause of the problem in Parkinson's or any disease of aging. No disease of aging is, proteins are really one of the most important things we have. They are good until they can no longer work for us. It's not like they are good until they turn evil, as the narrative of Parkinson's suggests.
Oh my goodness. And I see that we only have 10 minutes and I have about 100
No.
questions left to ask you, but this is fascinating, really fascinating. So I would like to really briefly go back and touch on the Cincinnati cohort biomarker program that you talked about. This brilliant idea and how you're doing
Yeah.
it. 'Cause somebody asked, like, how do we participate? Could we? I don't live in Cincinnati. How do I participate? So, and then a little bit about precision medicine. And
Yes,
then if
absolutely.
we still have time,
Yeah,
I'd
we
love to
do.
talk
We
about,
do.
as we wrap this up, what are the takeaways? What we're learning? What should people do knowing this? So let's start with Cincinnati cohort biomarker program and precision medicine.
Yeah. So this is the hardest and longest and the most difficult thing that I've ever been involved in, but it's the only one we have to do it. We have to figure out when Mary comes to me with Parkinson's, I need to eventually tell Mary why that happened. The why happened is the most important of all questions for Mary, and it'll be important for Jim and George and everyone. That can only be done in an individualized fashion. We must be able to understand the individual biology of everyone coming into Parkinson's. We don't want to know why Mary and Jim and George have the same thing because we know it's not the same thing. So whatever is common across them all cannot be relevant for the cause of their individual diseases. So the Cincinnati cohort biomarker program is essentially doing the analysis in a manner that recognizes the individuality of everyone in the study. And we're looking at people from the biology, not from their symptoms. So that's very important. So that's the first thing. Precision medicine is what we hope to get to with CCBP, with the cohort that we're having here. We want to be able to match people that today would have therapies that would change their disease for the better, that would reverse their disease if we knew who they were biologically. And that's something that cannot be done unless we go into the study. So it's essentially a fishing expedition finding the needle in a haystack at a time that happens to have a match out there in the world of therapies. We have probably already in our pharmacy shelves therapies that worked to reverse the disease for many people. We just don't know who they are. This is what the CCBP is about, is knowing who they are, finding the therapies for people who already need them today. That's precision medicine. The other element of disease modification does allow a little bit of lumping. Because I said precision medicine requires splitting. The exception is the lumping for rescue therapies. I've said that in Parkinson's disease, one thing that happens is that the protein synuclein becomes compromised. The levels, when we measure them in spinal fluid, are low. What if we bring those levels up to normal? There could still be something happening in that brain, but we're bringing the protein to the normal levels. So allow the protein to exert its normal function. That would be referred to as rescue therapy. So precision medicine, the finest form of splitting, matching one individual to a therapy that would work for them. Rescue medicine is essentially increasing the levels of the normal proteins to where they need to be for the brain to be healthy. That collectively is disease modification, slowing the progression of people with Parkinson's, maybe reversing. Actually, in fact, we expect not just to slow progression, to reverse the disease. And we expect to find cures. Cures must be known as a plural, cannot be the cure for Parkinson's. There will be cures because what's going to cure Mary's Parkinson's won't be what's going to cure Jim's Parkinson's. And
Yes.
then the other form of lumping is symptomatic therapies. We're still doing a lot of studies trying to help improve the delivery of levodopa, for instance, with subcutaneous infusions. That's very important. So there is a lot of work going in that direction. But the hardest of all works is to really get to precision medicine and rescue medicine. But that requires all of us to be in the same mindset.
Can people participate in the CCBP,
Yeah,
the
it's only
Cincinnati
a one.
Cohort Biomarker
Yes.
Program?
Thank you for asking. Yes, it's only a once-a-year visit. And the only invasive part is a blood draw. We're not collecting spinal fluid because it would be very difficult to do that. Urine and stools. And then there's a variety of other scales and questionnaires that we use to understand diet, to entire history of exposures, et cetera, et cetera. So we are doing what's called deeply phenotyping, but the most important information, of course, comes from blood, potentially from stools, from the microbiome. So it's only once a year. The first visit is about 3 hours total. Then subsequent years, the visits come down to about an hour.
All right, last question that's going to, I hope, wrap this up about subtypes. How might understanding subtypes
Yeah.
help somebody in their daily life and take action to feel better or?
Yeah, so I want to go back to what to me has been one of the most important stories shaping the way I view everyone. Subtyping ultimately is a concept that we are trying to use to admit that everybody's different. What this means is that each person listening to us has so much power within that we don't tap it, that's there, that it requires to believe. I know I said belief is not the language of science, but it's definitely the language of humanity. The reason so many drugs do not make it to the market is because the placebo effect, which is the belief that something will work, is so powerful in Parkinson's. We don't have stem cell therapies in this country because the first time they were given, people were walking out of a wheelchair. So we figured that's a cure, right? And then what happened is that when then the trial was done to compare sham stem cells to actual stem cells, sham stem cells, people that thought they had stem cells, but they didn't receive it, also walked out of their wheelchairs. How does that happen? Because there is an amazing biological effect in belief. Placebo effect is not nothing, is actually powerful. We want to harness it. Because there are actual changes in the brain of people who believe. And that was brought to me in the most starkest of fashion when I thought somebody would die within 3 years and still 2 decades later doing everything because she didn't believe my story that I was putting something. She said, I am too busy. I have too many things going on. I have this and that and this and this. And I know that I'm going to. Yes. So she believed that Parkinson's wasn't going to define her. The Parkinson's wasn't going to dictate what she would do or wouldn't do. And to me, she is an example of what everyone can do if you believe. That's ultimately the best part of subtyping. It's just to recognize you're your own subtype. No one has your subtype. You have it. You're blazing your own trail. And so you make the best of that trail.
What powerful words to conclude our conversation. And I see in the chat that folks are saying, bring Alberto back. We want to have more conversations. So we'd love to be
Love
able
to.
to do this and continue the conversation. And yeah, talk about more of this. This is so helpful. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your passion for serving our community for so many years in such a brilliant way. And thank you to all of you who've tuned in.